And then once you get in the males industry, that's it, right? You're yeah. in. And for me, like learning, right? That's 15, 20 years ago, learning the global nature of the business, recognizing that, holy moly, it's everywhere, right? You don't, when you're not in the industry, you take steel and aluminum products for granted, but they're absolutely everywhere, right? They're in that can of beer, right? That can of beer is made out of metal. So it's, yeah, I kind of just got hooked in it, and I really enjoyed the kind of global nature of it, how the markets are independent of each other. And then once I realized what a big impact it had, not just in people's lives on a daily basis, but it's an economic powerhouse, right? So the automotive industry is powered by metals, the construction industry is powered by metals, much of the consumer market, whether it's durable goods, is powered by metals. Even, you know, people don't realize vacations are powered by metals.
Greg Sheldon here, your host of Metal, Steel, Manufacturing, and Business Pro podcast, where you learn everything about the metals and manufacturing industry that make your modern day life possible.
Welcome, everybody. So today we are very pleasured to have John Armstrong of Rebus. And, you know, he really doesn't need an introduction because we all pretty much know who he is by now, because he's made such a ruckus. And then also, you know, he's doing such great things, and there's articles about him and his thought process behind it. And we were just discussing some of the things on the mantle, some awards and some trinkets from, I love the beer story. That's really cool, John. Would you, by the way, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you for having me, right? I'm really looking forward to it.
Good. Yes. Yeah, so the IPA, it's 9%. Is that what you said?
Yeah. So the cans of beer up behind us. Yeah. The story is we were about to sponsor an event, Happy Hour, just as COVID broke out. So that to cancel the in-person event, and they moved it to a virtual event. So we came up with the idea to send everybody that was attending the event some beer so they could celebrate the cocktail hour virtually. Yeah. The conference that was SMU, they worked with us and enabled us to make that happen. But instead of just buying anybody's old beer, we actually commissioned our own beer. And that was the fun part. We actually did a tasting, right? We had to taste all these different beers, and we did a blind tasting, and our team, it was a small company then, we were maybe 30 people. Yeah. We all did this tasting, and then we picked out which one we liked, and everybody really liked this one. It is really strong. You don't drink too many cans or you'll feel ill, but it's really tasty. So we managed to pull that off, send it out, and everybody really appreciated it.
Interesting. I'm curious, are you like a real beer fan, or are you more like a Coors, Bud Light kind of guy?
Yeah. So I come from Scotland. For those that don't know, so that yeah. probably answers the question. I like IPAs, pale ales, that type of stuff. But I'm more a wine drinker than a beer drinker, particularly.
Okay, fair enough. But if it was, I'm not much of a beer drinker either. But if I'm gonna drink a beer, I want one that tastes like a beer. So
yeah, right. It should have beer flavor to it, and it's light beer isn't really a thing outside of the U.S. There's not a lot of places to buy a Bud Light or a Miller Light. Like you can't really buy that much outside the U.S. So it's a U.S. thing.
Speaking of beer, I always hear this about Guinness, where everybody says it's heavy and all this stuff, which I totally disagree with. I think Guinness is one of the lightest beers going, and it's just, there's something about it. I love it. It doesn't have that. You don't get that bloated feeling like you do from, you know, North American beers. I'm curious what you think of Guinness.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I would say it's one of my favorite beers. I do have some cans just around the corner there. I like to cook a little bit in my spare time. And one of the things I make is steak and ale pie. And the ale is Guinness. I use two bottles of Guinness go into the to make the gravy for the steak and ale pie, and it's phenomenal in that. But yeah, like again, back in the UK, like they used to recommend Guinness to pregnant women until about the 1980s. Right? You should drink a can of Guinness; it'll make you feel better. It's pretty much part of the day-to-day culture there. So yeah, a nice cool Guinness at the end of the day is not a bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It always cure what ails you.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they say.
That's what they say. Yeah. Cool, man. Well, hey, look, thank you for coming, and love the beer talk, but I'm sure everybody listening loves the beer talk too. But
yeah,
let's talk about the metal industry and Rebus. And before we get to Rebus, I mean, what's your story, man? Why are you doing what you're doing, which is remarkable, but like, why metal? Why do you care?
Yeah. So funnily enough, it wasn't the original plan, right? As a young boy, I was at school going, one day I'm going to get into the metals industry. So, you know, around 20 years ago, I was moving from a very large international company, Saint-Gobain, in Europe. And I got the opportunity to join a company that manufactured products out of metal in the UK, windows, doors, shower enclosures, siding, you know, all aluminum or steel based. So the opportunity was really a career move to become a director of a company in the UK, and it was a broad commercial kind of procurement role combined, and that's really when I got to learn the industry. But I think I'm sure other guests have said this too, it's kind of once you get in the metals industry, that's it, right? You're in. And for me, like learning, right, that's as I say, that's nearly 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, learning the global nature of the business, recognizing that, holy moly, it's everywhere, right? You don't, when you're not in the industry, you take steel and aluminum products for granted, but they're absolutely everywhere, right? They're in that can of beer, right? That can of beer is made out of metal. So it's, I kind of just got hooked in it, and I really enjoyed the kind of global nature of it, how the markets are independent of each other. And then once I realized what a big impact it had, not just in people's lives on a daily basis, but it's an economic powerhouse, right? So the automotive industry is powered by metals, the construction industry is powered by metals, much of the consumer market, whether it's durable goods, is powered by metals. Even, you know, people don't realize vacations are powered by metals. You get in a plane, you get in a ship, right? You go on a cruise ship, it's full of steel, right? It's made of steel. So I think once I realized what it was and enjoyed that, the travel part, enjoyed learning new things. One experience that sticks out in particular was there's an aluminum company in Greece called Elval.
Okay.
Massive, huge company in Europe in particular. And I got to go visit their largest facility in Greece, right? And you go in there and they're a direct cast mill. So they're making these large slabs of aluminum, then they roll them down, make cans. And the scale of that, right, the fact from one end of the machine to the other was a kilometer away. The fact that they were storing, you know, 20,000 pound aluminum coils six stories high in this kind of Mad Max, you know, end of the world apocalyptic storage system that was hot and dusty and huge, you feel really small when you're there, or visit the blast furnaces down. I remember the first time I went to Birmingham and saw US Steel's blast furnace down there. It's like looking into the core of the air, right? It's such a big thing. So the sparks, like, you know, the heat, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So all of those experiences kind of just hooked me on it, and I'm really glad it did.
Yeah, man. I can relate. Like, I feel like a little kid when I go into places that are just, everything's big like that, right? I think that's part of the allure for me anyway. And always architecture too always does that to me, like driving through a big city and just seeing how much stuff is made out of metal, and especially bridges. I got an affinity for bridges. I don't know what it is, but I love them. And that's cool. So you kind of answered one of my biggest questions, was like, how do you explain our industry to people that aren't in it? And you had mentioned a story about when you're raising funding and stuff like that, and that came up. I wonder if you could kind of, are you able to just summarize that? Well, tell that story, but also how do you explain it to people that don't know?
Yeah. So here's the first thing. It is difficult. Like, it's not an insignificant task to actually explain it to people, because as I said earlier, it's so ingrained in our day-to-day life, we don't see it, right? We pick up a pot or a pan in the morning to make our breakfast. Yeah, that's probably got a steel handle and aluminum or a copper pot and or your kettle, and then you open your stainless steel fridge freezer and you check your HVAC, which is running through steel coil or steel square sheet that's been folded to make the unit. So people just don't realize it. So what I tend to do is, it, ideally, if it's in person or on a Zoom call, I'll actually just start pointing out the items that I can see in their background about that steel, and then I'll talk to them about, you know, how do you get to work today? Well, you know, I came in a car. Okay, well, 80% of that car was made of steel. How else did you come? Well, I drove down the road. But you realize there's rebar underneath the road and the Armco barriers made out of that. And you can see their eyes remembering their journey. And then when you got your office building, how tall is your office building? Well, it's 25 stories. It's definitely got steel framing in it, right?
Absolutely.
What floor do you work on? The sixth floor. Well, you got an elevator that's made out of steel that's pulled by steel wires. So I think when you kind of relate it to their everyday life, it can really, they start seeing it. And it's funny that the folks that join our company from outside the steel industry, I warn them, once they see it, they'll never unsee it, right? And they'll sometimes call me, you know, they're like, I was sat on the highway next to this big truck, and then I just realized the wheels made of steel, the nuts are made of steel, the siding's made of aluminum, and like, yes, that's it, right? They're stuck in traffic. And they can see it moving all around them, and the bridge they're on, the hook to the steel support or something. So, yeah, I think once you highlight to people, but you got to turn it into like a life experience. Like, throwing statistics at them, you know, it's 3% of global GDP. Okay, what does that mean? But I think when you turn it into their journey to work or their vacation or their immediate surroundings that they're in, or, you know, if they play sports, maybe they're using, people don't realize golf clubs are made of steel, aluminum, titanium, right? But it's carbon fiber, but people realize that's a steel tube that's on the shaft of their club. Like, they just don't get, like, it's everywhere. You're touching it everywhere. All day, every day, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, and it's endless. I mean, even the smartphones and the power that gets to us.
Look, somebody smarter than me, I think I stole it from somebody, but like the modern world doesn't exist without it.
That's right.
Like think about it. Like, you know, we're blessed in these days and ages. If we get ill, we can go to the doctors, and if we need to get surgery, we can get surgery. Well, the type of surgery that's achieved now with these super fine, super sharp blades and, you know, the stainless steel that helps keep those environments for operations clean, the gas storage for the drugs that knock you out in the storage cylinder. None of that exists without a successful metals industry. So life expectancy would be less if we hadn't discovered how to use steel, aluminum, copper, brass, all the four metals in our day-to-day life. So pretty important, right? And we should think about that and realize that it doesn't, vacations are fun, right? Going on a ship on a cruise is fun, but you can't get access to that or store food, right? Tins of beans, good fashioned tin of beans. How do you do that without metals, right? You can't store it in paper for that length of time. It'll go off or et cetera. So yeah, I'm excited about it. And look, I'm excited for the future of it too, because I think if people are realizing that plastics are pretty tough for the planet, right? They're pretty tough, and it's affecting into people's the food chain now, you know, where clean the sea, fish are, you know, particles of plastics inside them, etc. I think we'll continue to see a shift away from maybe some other products into steel and aluminum, particularly as the products continue to enhance or reduce their impact on the environment, enhance the green credentials.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I had a gentleman on, John Sacco, a couple of episodes ago, and he was talking about the recycling industry and how much more sense it makes environmentally than plastics and all those sorts of things, right? I mean, there's a lot of regulation around it, and it gets this bad rap, but metal makes so much more sense because it's recyclable and it can just be reused.
Yeah, and it can be reused. And look, the good thing about steel and aluminum products is they last a long time too.
Yeah.
Right? They last a long time in that original purpose. And, you know, when steel and aluminum is in a raw state, it's fungible. Right? So a piece of siding that comes off of a building today can be recycled and turned into siding on an RV. And that can be recycled and turned into a storage container. Then it can be recycled and turned into something else. So you got that flexibility as it goes through its life cycle. It's the same with steel. Like a piece of steel that comes from a car, I guess remelted and repurposed, it could turn up in a building or it could turn up in a piece of office furniture. So the fact that it can move around the market, it doesn't have to keep going back to the same market, I think is another core advantage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Cool, man. So Rebus, so your story, how did we get to, like, was there a pain point you recognized and then said, well, there needs to be a solution to this? Is that how Rebus came about, or how is that story?
Yeah, kind of, but what really happened before was a much more personal pain point, right? So, okay. You know, having climbed the corporate ladder, right? I was doing okay. I had a global procurement. That was a great job. I ended up running the Fabral Metal Roofing Company, and I loved that. I really loved that job, but I was never fulfilled. And you know, the culture at the company was tough and challenging for me, and I wasn't happy. And that really manifested at home, right? You spend a lot of time at work, and you start bringing that home. And you know, huge credit to my wife. She called me out on it. She called me out and says, "Hey, man, yes. Your behavior's not acceptable. You're bringing the persona that you're using at work. You're bringing the tough time you're having at work. You're bringing it home. It's affecting me. It's affecting our kids. You need to figure this out, because that's not a good way to live our lives." And it was really, that was the spark, right? That was the catalyst to say, I need to do something different, which led me to the thoughts of, well, what could I do, right? And obviously, my experience in procurement, supply chain, seeing the impact firsthand, seeing the industry firsthand, whether it's the story in Greece or blast furnace in the US or paint line in Taiwan, and seeing all the complexities and really having to deal with those problems, right? And I must say, rather unsuccessfully, right? I was working hard to deal with them, but we still had lots of challenges and issues in that supply chain. So it was really that combination of, like, you know, go do something that makes you happy. We all spend a lot of time at work, right? We all spend a lot of time there. And, you know, some people want value and growth and challenge and a career out of it. And that's me, right? I want to be challenged. I want to learn and grow if I can. So I needed to create an environment where that was possible. Now, the problem with that is, to create a company where that's possible, it actually has to be successful, right? Mm-hmm. If it's not a viable, real company, it's very hard to sustain that, because it's going to be tough day after tough day after tough day.
Yes.
So realizing I had some expertise in the metals industry, combining that, I really like data, right? I love numbers. I like putting the numbers together, and I like visualizing numbers and putting them together. So that kind of data-driven part, along with understanding the industry and the desire to create an organization where I want to work, kind of those things collided together. And then that's where the concept comes. And, you know, as I was leaving my other company, I was fortunate I had some, you know, nice time off, and I started kind of socializing the concept of, hey, I want to get in the industry and help people find stuff. And people I knew, you know, folks at US Steel that I knew, people, you know, some of my suppliers that I knew, some of my customers would tell me their pain points, and they would resonate with me. I would recognize them too. I would literally be spitballing, like, what if I could do this? What if I could do this? How's about I could find it for you quicker? What if I could get rid of some of your stuff quicker? And just started kind of checking off what people thought was valuable, And I'm really grateful for that time. It's a good few months. Mm-hmm. So that kind of crystallized the concept of building Rebus to what it is today. And it the core of the business isn't much different from that back then. Right? That's four and a half years ago now.
Yeah. Well, that's got to be an ongoing thing, an ongoing challenge to, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I assume, you know, 4.5 years is a long time. You're always having to communicate and talk with the team and all that stuff. How has that been? I know for some people that's more challenging than others. For me, that would be. I'm just curious, you know, how that's gone for you.
Yeah, well there's a couple of things. It's I think when I started, I imagined the horizon. Like I imagined an endpoint. Every week, month, quarter, year, the horizon's actually getting further away. I'm not getting closer to it. I'm getting further away from it because the more I hear and the more I see and the more I learn about challenges, which for me equals opportunity, right? The challenge is the opportunity. The more I see of that, the more I want to do, the more I can see that we can solve. And I think one of the challenges in the last few years is saying no, right? For us, we don't see a lack of opportunity in the industry to digitize, modernize, and make the whole supply chain more efficient. There's thousands and thousands of opportunities, and whether it's in a product vertical, a market vertical, whether it's a service that runs across multiple verticals, mm-hmm. There's really endless opportunity there. But obviously, you know, what's great about Rebus, we create a company where you can do anything, but the reality of physics of life and time is you can't do everything.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Right? Right? Yeah. Unfortunately, right? So you got to kind of pick your challenges, pick your opportunities, pick your investments, pick where you're going to put the resources. So keeping the team on track with that, it's quite challenging because, you know, we surround ourselves with curious people. We surround ourselves with people that want to challenge the status quo. But then you got 1,000 opportunities, right? And, you know, the ones we've picked, some of them have worked really well. Some have worked okay. And some flat out have failed, right? We got it wrong, or it was the wrong time, or we did it wrong, or, you know, we mm-hmm. just, it just didn't work. So, but that's okay, right? As I say, there's endless more opportunities to do. And it's sometimes in life, it's better to know what not to do than actually what to do, right? If you got 1 to 100 possibilities and you've made 50 mistakes, well, now you've only got 50. So your chance of success actually could increase because you've narrowed down the field of, okay, we know that doesn't work, so we're going to try this. And eventually, if you're persistent and gritty, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, absolutely. So would you say that's what it is, persistence and grit?
Yeah, look, no, nothing worth doing is easy.
No.
Right? And, no. You know, I talk about this all the time. It's, you know, logically, intellectually, our business model of creating liquidity, matching buyers and sellers, simplifying processes, allowing new sales channels for free for customers, new procurement channels for free for customers, financing products, simplifying logistics. Intellectually and logically, it makes complete sense. Mm-hmm. So why isn't everybody doing it? Because that's not actually the hurdle. The hurdle is hearts and minds, right? And it, you know, you got to work hard at that. If somebody's been doing something in a similar way for 15, 20 years, one meeting, one conversation is not going to change their heart and mind, right? Intellectually, it can make sense. But you got to change how they feel about it. You got to change, you overcome their objections. You got to overcome their fears, right? Where a lot of these objections come from. I don't know. Like, it doesn't matter how good you are at selling or how good you are at marketing. You're going to have to demonstrate success. You're going to have to demonstrate value. And it just takes time. I think being persistent, you know, we call that gritty at our company. Pushing through, right, continuing to go, riding through the mistakes, right, and accepting them as learnings. I think that's been a really important thing. And you know, for me, grit is perseverance with a passion.
There you go.
Right? So yeah. It's not like some people are gritty in that kind of begrudgingly, oh, I'll work hard and I'll get you through it. Wouldn't your day be really much better if you could turn up and say, I get a chance to change something today. I know it's going to be hard, but I'm going to have fun doing it. Right? Yeah. And it's kind of like some people really enjoy marathons, right? Some people, it's a begrudging thing they feel they have to complete. But the people that are best in it are doing it with a smile on their face.
Yeah.
Right? Which is a foreign concept to somebody that's really struggling it, but maybe it's just their mindset, right? So yeah. We try and tackle the gritty, the hard things with passion. And that's difficult. Like, sustain that over a long period of time. Ignore, you know, the naysayers. Ignore all of that and keep going and keep going. Yeah, I think it takes grit, right? I think that's a great definition of grit.
Fair enough. There's always the naysayers. We've all, any entrepreneurs learn that the hard way. And sometimes it's
through history.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it does get to you, but then, you know, you sleep on it and it's like, you know what? I got a vision. I got a thing. I'm going to do it. But you learn from what they're saying too, right? It doesn't mean you have to act on it and quit. It just means you learn. Like, they've got a perspective that maybe you need to consider, right?
Yeah, no, you got to pivot. And things change, right? Just because you were right 4 years ago doesn't mean you're right now. But look, a description I like is vision, right? People say, oh, that person's got a vision. I go, vision is not about what you see. It's seeing things other people don't see. That's what vision is, right?
Yeah, yes.
So unfortunately, the definition of the vision is not everybody's going to see what you see.
Right.
So if you're actually doing something different, you're going to have naysayers. You're going to have people say, you know, gosh, it still comes up even now, like something that comes up as it. Rebus will never work. E-Steel failed in 2003. Right? Like, somebody will actually say, I saw E-Steel and it didn't work then, so why would it not work now? And it's like, well, things change, right?
Yes.
That was before the iPhone was invented.
Yes. It's a long time ago in technology. Yeah.
Right? There was no apps then. Apps didn't exist then. You know, Google was only a few years old. Amazon was still selling books.
Mm-hmm.
So if you listen to that piece of advice, right, you would give up. But you gotta have some belief, you gotta have some faith that if you keep trying to do the right thing, eventually you'll figure it out. And over time, folks will see the value and you keep pushing forward. So yeah, you gotta have a bit of a thick skin, I think. And and accept that you might actually be wrong. That's okay. Right? Yeah. You might fail. And learn along the way and adjust or go do something else. That's okay too.
Yeah, yeah. Something I think of often, you brought up last time we talked, was expectations and setting those early on. And I'd love to hear, well, I've got a question. I don't want to forget it. Don't let me forget it.
Yeah.
About emotions versus price. But the story of raising money, and if you could just share that, it was such a great, you know, story about, you know, what your expectations were going into that, you know, if you could.
Yeah. So, you know, very early on, I knew to maximize the potential of Rebus and really attract technology, we had to be backed by the venture capital world, right? And ideally from Silicon Valley or New York, right? Where the real money is and we can get the support from that. So I had this idea that once we can get some proof of concept and we get going, we'll go raise some venture capital money so we can invest properly, right? And that supports the persistence and time thing. Like, it's going to take time. And look, it's a massive industry, right? So globally, it's a $3 trillion industry. If we're going to make an impact that actually matters, it's going to cost some money, right? It's not going to happen for free, right? So with the ambition of, I want to make a proper impact in the industry, not a small one, a real one, and realizing it was time, it was obvious we had to raise some venture capital. And of course, I had zero experience in doing that until I started Rebus. Absolutely none, right? So I started listening to podcasts, actually. Podcast started it. And there's a great podcast I'd recommend to everybody. It's by Reid Hoffman, founder of one of the first few guys at PayPal, founder of LinkedIn. And then, you know, he's at Greylock Partners, one of the most respected VC firms in the world. So he does this podcast called Masters of Scale. And what's interesting, you can listen to the stories of the founders at Airbnb or these type of companies. And Tim Ferriss does a similar one on like how it was built. Mm-hmm. So listening to a lot of those podcasts, I think it was a guy at Airbnb said, you know, I kind of set a goal that I'd take 100 no's until I get to a yes from a VC. And I was like, I'm competitive. So I was like, okay, well, maybe mine will be 500. So I mentally went into the process thinking, I might get rejected 500 times. And it's the 501st conversation that's going to actually make it happen for us. Mm-hmm. And what was great about that is I was all revved up for that challenge. I'm like, this is going to take 3 to 6 months. The day, 10 phone calls a day, get ready. This is going to be a slog. But luckily, one of the guys that was helping me at the time, David, he knew a guy that knew a guy that worked at one of the best VCs for startups in Silicon Valley, Initialized Capital. So I think I've got to 3 no's, and then I learned that one. So I jumped on that opportunity. We had no money at the time, so yeah. Bought an economy ticket to San Francisco, went out, bought this guy a nice expensive dinner with almost all the money I had left. He helped me arrange a meeting with the team at Initialized Capital, and you know, me and my friend weren't staying in a great hotel or anything, right?
Yes. You
know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner with Starbucks, right? It was that type of trip. But yeah, we got that opportunity to kind of tell the Rebus story to some really serious and successful investors out there, and they saw the value. And very quickly after that, we got our kind of first investment, and it was good. And something, it's a funny story, right? It's like one of the people, early rejectors, well, actually didn't even reject us. They just ignored us as one of our current investors, right? So I wrote, you know, on their website, says, hey, we like to invest in new companies changing old industries. We believe the industrial market is ripe for disruption. We believe that working in big old industries can be a lot of value making. This investor's perfect for us, right? An investment thesis matches up with a business model. I wrote them a email. I sent them a hard copy letter. I reached out directly on LinkedIn, sent messages. Nothing, not even a response. 9 months after that, they reached out to us saying, hey, your business matches our thesis. We should talk about investing. And that company actually led our seed round.
Huh. Wow, so, man.
The timing wasn't right, or, you know, I didn't have enough proof, or they were busy, or it doesn't mean it was the wrong thing. And sure enough, and they've invested in our company 3 times now. So they've been a really good partner, and they've helped us out a lot. But they ignored us the first time.
Well, and that's it. That's what, same with buyers. Like, they're not always ready right now, you know? They will be ready if you're bringing the value down the road. So that's why the consistency and persistence and grittiness is important. So what you're saying is it's all about buying a guy dinner. That's it.
Yeah. It was, God, I was pitching hard those days, man. Like, and that was cramming in the, how does the steel industry work? And, you know, like, you know, you're getting like 20, 30 minutes to explain the massive industry, all the challenges in it, your vision for fixing it, and what you're going to do when you actually get the money. And you got 20, 30 minutes to get that across to somebody. You know, we're not a true SaaS company in terms of like the software. So, you know, they're thinking, are they like Salesforce? No, they're nothing like Salesforce. Is it like Uber? Well, kind of, but not really. And, you know, they know what it's like to get a taxi. So they understand Uber. They know what it's like to go book a hotel, so they understand Airbnb.
Yeah.
well, the supply chain of steel is kind of broken and these things don't connect properly. It's hard for them to get that concept. I heard somebody said, why don't they all just call US Steel and get their steel? Right? The idea that not every single person that needs steel just calls US Steel and gets steel is really hard to, like, there's lots of reasons for that, but, but they're not all simple. So trying to distill that all down into a story that somebody that doesn't understand the industry gets is pretty difficult. But look, what's always been in our favor and continues to be today is Rebus has always been able to generate good unit economics.
What do you mean by that?
Right. So any fundraising story, and particularly now, right, fundraising not being so difficult the last few years, but certainly in the last 9 months and maybe the next year, it's going to continue to be challenging, is you got to have a real business. You got to have a business that shows that it can, you know, get to profitability. The days of, hey, let's start a business and we'll figure out it'll be profitable one day, they're not as attractive anymore to investors. They want to see that your business can actually prove you can provide your service, do your thing for a price, charge more than it costs you to do it. Because that's a business, right? You're in business to make money, you're in business to return value to shareholders, stakeholders, etc. So Rebus has always had a model where every time we help somebody find something or help them sell something or move their logistics or finance their product, we get a little bit. So being able to demonstrate that, the adopters that joined Rebus in the early days, they've been extremely loyal. Right, so they've stayed with us, and they've, you know, maybe they bought one truck from us in their first year. But 5 years later, they're buying 100 trucks of steel and using our logistics service and using our financing service. So, over again, time and persistence, over time, they've moved from a $50,000 revenue customer to a $10 million revenue customer over 4 years. So that's great unit economics, right? That's good business economics. And having them with me along with the story, I think of it, you know, being from the steel industry, not being in San Francisco, not being a typical VC kind of target. I think if we didn't have those strong unit economics and the good track record of our customers staying with us, it wouldn't have happened, right? And again, it's about, that might be luck, it might be circumstance, all of those things, but having the right things at the right time allowed that to happen. And if, I think if we didn't have the relationship with the guy, it would never have happened. If we didn't have the unit economics, it would never have happened either. So I think it's good to be lucky sometimes.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's more than that, but that's, I mean, we gotta stay humble, but luck is certainly a thing, and we can't measure it. That's the hardest thing about luck, right? It's such a,
I won't bore you with it. It's probably too long for this, but there's a fantastic, I think it's a Buddhist or Chinese proverb, and at the crux of it is the word maybe. And I actually try and teach my kids the word maybe, and I try to teach my leadership team the word maybe. Can I do it? It'll take a couple of minutes. Can I talk you through it?
Yeah, right? I would love to. Yeah.
Right. So, and I'm going to butcher it, right? I probably won't get it 100%, right? Okay. But from memory, it basically goes, there's a guy, the Chinese guy with a family. His wife's dead. He only had one child. Child's working in the city. And he's working in the fields, and just outside the city. And he's working in the fields one day, and his horse heels over and dies while it's plowing the field. So all his friends come around and his neighbors and go, hey, that's really bad news. And he goes, maybe. And then the next day, he gets a letter from his son. He's been laid off from his big office job in the country, and he's going to have to come home. Mm-hmm. And his neighbors and friends say, well, that's good news. Your son will be able to help you on the farm. And he says, well, maybe. And then his son's at the farm for a little bit. And just by luck, there's some conflict going on a few hundred miles away. But so horses escape from that, and they bolted through the village. But because his son was there, he was a lot younger and fitter, he managed to capture two horses. And now they've got two horses to play with the field. And all the neighbors come around and go, this is fantastic news. It's really, really good news. And he says, maybe. And the young son is out in the field the next day with his two young horses. They don't really know what they're doing. He's not that experienced. And they tip over the plow and it breaks his leg. So everybody huddles around again. He says, that's really bad news. And he says, maybe. And now, remember that war thing I was talking about?
Yeah.
So they were losing the war. So the general came to the village and he wanted every able-bodied person under 30 to come to the war, even though 50% of the people who went to the war died. And they saw his son and they walked straight past him with his broken leg, so he didn't have to go.
Wow. Yeah, man. That's awesome.
So when something happens, so the whole kind of thesis is that if something happens to you, you don't know if it's actually good or bad at that moment. You know how you feel about it. Mm-hmm. You might feel good. You might feel bad. You don't actually know if it was good or bad at the time. So this great thing happened. Maybe it was great. You don't know yet, right? And if you take that to our personal life, right?
Of course, that's what I was thinking about.
Everybody's had relationships that didn't end up how they thought they were going to, right?
Yes.
I have, I'm sure you have, and I'm sure everybody listening has. And, you know, at the moment in time, you know, in the throes of passion or the beginning of that relationship, like, this is the greatest thing ever. Maybe.
Right? Maybe.
And, you know, for me, one time it was, right? With my wife, right? It was the greatest time ever. There was plenty of times it wasn't. And I guarantee you, people on the other side of that would say the same thing, right?
Of course.
What's it, right? So you don't know. You think you know, but you don't really know. You don't know. Who was it?
I talked
to John Blount in our company the other day. And, right, we all sometimes forget something at home when we leave for the office.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We all do it. So the normal reaction, that's frustration. God damn it, this sucks. I have to go back to the house. I need to go do this. And then you go and you have to spend a few minutes and you find your wallet on top of the microwave. And then you go. So that delayed you 15 minutes. Was that a good thing or a bad thing? You don't know.
Maybe.
Right? Maybe a semi-truck run a red light and you weren't there because you had to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the semi-truck is just about to hit you because you're 15 minutes late.
Yeah.
You don't know if that was a good or a bad thing when it happened. You just assume it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
And if you can kind of calm the frustration down and just kind of roll with it of like,
mm-hmm.
it'll work its way out.
Yes.
You just don't know. And it could be a simple, small thing like that.
Yeah. And that I've found in life is, you know, a lot of people go in different directions with this. It could be faith. It could be religion. It could be Buddhism, whatever. And the biggest lesson from it is don't try and control. For me, it was try. Don't try and control your day so much, you know?
Yeah. I think it's about what you can control is how you react to what happens. You can't control what happens. And look, gosh, that's at the core of the Rebus product is, you know, when I was in the supply chain, you know, I was trying to use machine learning to do advanced forecasting models. Okay. Gosh, we had this really clever guy, Derek. He came from Starbucks, right? So he was like a data modeling expert and he tried to figure out how to model Starbucks works.
Mm-hmm.
He came to work with us. So we even went to the degree of checking historical weather report at a county level, right? A US county level. Cross-match that against a historical sales performance.
Okay.
At a hue and color level and use that as a weighted factor into our forecasting for our material.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I was trying to control the weather.
But it's still interesting information.
Yeah, no, right. But it was interesting.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, like there's so many, like so statistically, I was right.
Yeah.
Of course we know how the weather's going to be in April 2024, right? As you're making your forecast and you're trying to do it. So that was one of the experiences that got me to where Rebus sits in. Look, you're going to have problems. you're going to have issues. Stuff will go wrong. Stuff that's gone wrong before will go wrong again. Stuff that's never went wrong before will go wrong for the first time, and you're going to try something new, and that might go wrong too.
Yeah.
Or it might go well at the moment, but maybe it's just going to go wrong later. So instead of trying to control everything and make sure nothing goes wrong, Rebus has got more of a, look, we're going to help you. You got to have flexibility to roll with the punches, to roll with the challenges. Mm-hmm. So that's one fundamental difference at Rebus. We're not trying to like fix everybody's problems. I don't think they're actually fixable, right? We're hearing it right now in Los Angeles, right? It's just happened again, and it's happened before, and it's happened before. Is there some employment disruption at the fore? So stuff getting offloaded from the ship slower than it normally does, mm-hmm. which the ripple effect down the supply chain is somebody's waiting on some steel right now, and they don't know when they're going to get it, right? They're calling up, where it's on the ship, man, I just can't get a firm date of when it's going to get unloaded. Mm-hmm. What do you do about that? You can't change that. You're not going to pick up the ship and move it. You can't. You can't storm the port. You can't, you know, there's not much you can do about it. It's uncontrollable.
Yeah.
But what you can do is have a series of tools that allow you to manage those ups and downs, those puts and takes.
Yeah.
So we really focus on trying to create flexibility and liquidity and transparency and visibility to the market. Mm-hmm. We can manage these problems as opposed to, you know, many consultancy firms will come with, this is how you should forecast. For everything that's happened before, in exactly the same way, exactly the same time, exactly. All I've learned from trying to do that is whatever I did then, I was only right for the second I decided I was right. Mm. And as soon as I said that's what's going to happen, something happened somewhere in the world and I was just wrong. You lose a customer, the weather changes, but design influences changes, the color you thought was popular stops being unpopular, or you know, the cousin of a guy that never used to work in the industries just went to your competitor. So now that guy's going to buy steel from him. Like,
yep.
How do you forecast first?
You can't.
You can't, right? And maybe that guy's one of your largest customers and you're going to lose 50% of your business. You know that's going to happen 18 months from now? Of course you don't. No. And vice versa, maybe it happened to you. You're the guy that hired the cousin of the guy. So you've now got 50% more business than you thought you had. Right? Did you forecast for that? Like you didn't know, right? So, right. So Rebus is about giving you tools to manage that uncontrollable variability, mm-hmm. Which isn't always fault. It can be best intentions, but something else out of your control happened. And we try and help people with that.
Yeah. So creating those tools so that people can manage their own expectations, right? So
yeah.
Real-time information or as close to real-time as you can get, right?
Yeah. So, and just visibility. I think that's really important. Knowing what's out in the market available today really shortens the lead time and your ability to react. You can react quicker, right? From my own experience, we had a very large customer at Fabral, and I won a 5,000-pound coil on a plane and flew it from Washington to Wisconsin to delight the customer, right? I didn't want to disappoint the customer. I didn't want to stop his production line. I didn't want to stop any of that. So we did that. Imagine if I'd known that exact same coil was sitting 20 miles away down the street in Wisconsin.
Oh my gosh. Don't tell me that's what happened.
No, I don't know that. I know it does happen, right?
But yes.
So you know, I think I paid $8,000 for
that. Oh, yeah.
Right, to do a $4,000 sale, right, which I normally made 10% on.
But
it was a huge risk, but I delighted the customer.
That's right. The lifetime value of that supersedes any of that cost, right?
Yeah. So that's one of the things we try and talk about with our customers is if you use our platform, your chance to say yes to your customer has just increased.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you take that chance?
Yeah.
That you can say yes more. It's not going to be less, it's going to be more. And, you know, if you decide to say no to that customer, mm-hmm. maybe that coil isn't available in the end of the day, or the economics just don't suit your company to ship it that way. All you've done is create an opportunity for your customer to discover a new supplier. discover your competitor, build a relationship with the competitor. But by taking a few minutes and looking at our listings, looking at our access to materials, you got a chance to say yes instead of no. And I think that's worth a lot.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Yeah, for sure. So we're all trying to do a better job for our clients, and that just helps having the information, right? So
yeah, and not doing it doesn't help.
Right? No.
And that gets back to the logical thing.
Yes.
If you had access to more material, could you logically serve your customers better? Yes.
Yes.
So why don't you always look for more material? So it's not a logical thing, right? It gets back to the hearts and minds thing.
That's exactly right. So back to the hearts and minds also, I'm curious about your thoughts on why people buy. Is it about price or is it about emotions?
Oh, gosh. It's yes, yes, and yes to the other ones as well, right? So I think the answer is it depends, right? It depends on the buying circumstance. It depends on the buyer. It depends on the leader of the buyer. It depends on the challenges in the organization at the time, right? So if you've got a profit-first company, not customer-first company, price is going to be weighted higher in that person's decision-making process versus a company that's more customer-first, right? Like, we want to delight our customers. Price is going to be less important. And again, the challenge with that is that's not a static thing. It's not a static thing per customer. It's not a static thing per customer's customer. It's not a static thing per location, right? You might have one branch of a service center that's, you know, they've had a bad quarterly performance review on their margin. So he's super focused on price for that quarter. And then you got another one who's got bad performance review because he lost a lot of revenue because of poor service. So he's got a slight, you know, his weighting of price or value and service changes and modulates depending on the environment that they are operating in. They could have a, you know, somebody in the financial department gets promoted to a general leadership role.
Mm-hmm.
Tendency would be to focus on price, right? Yeah. So there maybe their leadership has changed and they're making them change their behavior. So yeah, it's that gets back to the multiple frequencies of the challenge of serving a customer, because it's not all the same thing. And it, you know, and if you take it in your home life, you know, the luxuries in my life, I'm less concerned about price. The basics in my life, well, I'm more focused about price.
That's right.
So the things that matter to me change. Right. It's not constant what matters to you.
Totally
things
fair.
That matter to you, you change. So I think, again, that gets back to why we're not saying, hey, we're the lowest price thing. We're not this, but like, we can help. We're here to help that solution. And if price is important to you, sometimes we can help, sometimes we can't. If availability is important to you, sometimes we can help, sometimes we can't.
Yeah. Right?
Because it changes. I think it's wrong to think it's a black or white, it's a one or the other.
Fair enough.
I think it's weighted and variable.
Very good. Great answer. I love it. Well, time's valuable, right? That's sometimes price doesn't matter if the time is right. So with that information that you can provide, that provides a value, right? So
yeah, look, something I've learned is people are a little naive about pricing. You know, here's a common refrain. You'll never sell to us because we buy direct from a steel mill. And you're like, so you've got the assumption the steel mill's giving you the best price in the market, right? And that's not true. Different companies negotiate different. The strategic priority for the steel mill might be different with one customer to another customer. Your buying power might be variable. Your percentage of volume you give the customer. The capacity utilization of one mill to another mill
could
be different at any given quarter time. The efficiency of making one product to another for every different. Millions and millions of variables. Way too often people think, yeah, I'm buying from a mill, it must be the best price possible. That's a bad assumption.
Yeah.
Right? It might be a good price, but the best price today or the best price tomorrow, you don't know. Of course you don't know. You should go discover. You should sense check that. So yeah, I think people get too hung up on that. And again, it's not a fixed thing. Right? It's not a fixed thing. The price moves. So when do you buy? When do you sell? It affects your price. When do you place your order? When do you receive your material? Affects your price. It's not that. There's no one price book that says each hot rolled coil is $28,000.
Yeah.
Not how it works.
It's
variable for lots of variables. So again, why you try to perfect that? Manage it.
Fair enough. I got some more questions. You have time?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've got two that I'm really curious about. SVB Bank and all that whole thing that happened. And the scare of bank runs and all that. Where is that now? Because I'm sure you got your finger on the pulse. And like, did you see any changes in your business or the metal or steel industry because of it?
Yeah. So for us, we actually banked with Silicon Valley Bank. Here's a good maybe story. And they were a great partner to us. It really helped us in our early days. But we needed to, you know, we have expanded globally, right? We do a lot of business outside of the US now. So we needed a bank that could help us on a global scale, right? In Europe and in Sweden and across into Mexico and some of the business we're doing in Asia. Mm-hmm. So we decided actually last year to move to a global bank. So we basically closed our accounts and really just had some customers were still paying us in some of those accounts. And I think we had like a letter of credit sitting out there for import duties, something like that. So we'd kind of shrunk our relationship down with Silicon Valley Bank over the last year. When it actually happened to us, we had a little bit of exposure. We had more than 250,000 in one account, mm-hmm. But that quickly unwound and really kind of took care of itself. So directly, I cash getting tied up or not being able to supply, pay suppliers or payroll, none of that happened to us. It happened to other people because they had all their money tied up and payroll was due to run and stuff, but we never had that impact. We had majority of our cash and the liquidity came from other sources, right? So
good.
So that was fortunate for us. But what definitely happened, and there's two points I'd like to make on it, is like the great thing about technology is you can access your money, move your money, you can move it all quickly.
Yes.
I would argue that bank run might never have happened without technology.
Why is that?
Because the pace of the ability to do withdrawals and move money from account to account enabled by technology meant it snowballed really, really quickly.
Fair enough.
But you go back 20 years,
it was
hard to move $1 million or $20 million from account to account. Yeah. Now you just go click, click, and it gets moved, right? So I think the technology didn't actually help too much there. Now, the concern I've got, and I think we've started to see it, is if you look at the history of banks, they're seldom isolated. Never one bank. And we've already seen Signature Bank and others have problems and issues too. And what that means is the lending industry, the banking industry, gets nervous, of course, right? And they're looking harder at their balance sheets. They're looking harder at the values of their treasury bonds. They're looking at their balance sheets, and they're trying to figure out how to protect themselves and optimize, which is going to restrict the availability of cheap cash, which the world has, for the last 10 years, has got kind of addicted to. Money doesn't cost much, so it's easy to get that money, and it's easier to get go do things with it. That's already harder with the interest rates, but it's getting harder because the banks are naturally, and it's a very sensible reaction, is to be more cautious, be more thoughtful, and just constrict that. And where I think it could fall into the steel industry is, you know, the steel industry is a cash flow industry, right? You got your receivables, you got your payables, and you got your inventory, right? So it's a big cash flow stream industry. Anybody's working at a senior level understands that managing that cash flow through the cycle of the industry is quite a challenge. The capital is more expensive and more constrained. That's going to affect our industry, right? And then when you layer on right now, again, from a historical basis, very high pricing, right? It's funny how we don't think $1,000 a ton for hot rolled pie anymore. Because it was 16, 17, 1800 bucks. But high used to be 700. High used to be 800. Now 1,000 doesn't seem so bad, right?
Fuel as well.
And fuel and cost and energy, all of these things, we're getting used to them at these elevated prices. So people need more capital at the time that capital is being restricted. Therefore, it's going to get harder. So that will come out, and because I'm involved in it and I like to learn these things, I'm tracking it quite closely.
Yes.
And many banks are stress testing their own balance sheet right now. There's still a perception, and we'll see, there's going to be some type of recession, which again will tighten up liquidity. So I think over time, like 3, 9, 12 months, a restriction of capital is going to change the way and impact the way the industry views its inventory and its cash flow.
Yeah. Yeah. So will those inventories get smaller, do you think?
Yeah, I think they'll be forced to. Like, they'll have to improve their cash turns, right? They'll have to get more efficient in moving those inventories through, because if the steel prices stay high and the cost of capital continues to increase, like, what's left in the middle gets squeezed. So you got to manage those inventories efficiently as possible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a really good segue to a question some people have today, and I'm curious your thoughts. Do you think, it's a question I have myself, do you think the industry will ever get to less credit, less period, like your payment periods of 30 days, or sometimes you're having these longer accounts receivable days of 60 to 90 to 120. Do you think those would ever get down to a smaller time frame? I know that's a complicated question, but
look, I think it's likely to extend instead of getting shorter.
Okay.
And that's because more of the world lives in credit than before, right? So people don't walk around with wallets of cash anymore, right? That's an unusual thing. Like, if somebody pulls out a wallet full of cash, you're like, why have you got all that cash, right? It's much more, people pay on credit. And if you look at the amount of credit held by consumers, right, on their credit cards or their mortgages or their automobile loans, it's still really, really high, like in historical terms, right? It just keeps going up. So that means somebody has to fund that. And as you go down the supply chain and the raw materials of steel that we're talking about in aluminum are right at the beginning of the supply chain. So the cash has to come from somewhere. So it gets pushed through. So no, unfortunately not. Like, at Rebus, our average, we've paid people in the last year on 32 days. Like, we try to pay on time, every time, as quick as we can. And we even, where possible, if people offer discounts for early payment, if we can, we'll try and take those to get the cash into the customer hands as quick as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The industry pays us in 48 days.
Yeah.
Right? On average, we get our cash back in 40 days. Some people pay in 32, some paying in 40, but some are paying in 60 when they're said they would pay in 30, right? Or some are even paying later than that. As that cash cycle goes through. So for our business, it's a challenge, right? The 12, 13, 15 days difference between when we pay people and when we get received, it's cash that our company has to flow, right? We have to flow that cash for people. Another reason why I think it might extend is it's actually a competitive advantage.
Okay.
If you allow your customers to pay slower, right, and give them longer terms, and they've got cash flow challenges in the organization, they are going to prefer you as a supplier as opposed to the person that cuts you off on day 31, right?
Interesting.
If you think about it, if you're a manufacturer, right, so let's just say we'll use metal roofing. It's dead easy, right? So they're a metal roofing manufacturer. You're likely having at least 60 to 90 days of inventory.
Right.
So you got 30 days payment terms. So you've tied up 45 days of cash. you got to turn that into a product. So you got to pay people, you got to pay for your building, you got to pay for your electricity, you got to pay for the truck, you got to pay for the maintenance of the machinery. So you're putting more and more and more cash into this product. 3-4 days later, it gets on a truck. Day later, it gets delivered. Then you invoice that person. On average, they'll pay you in 45 days. So think about it. That company has had to float that cash maybe 85 to 90 days, something like that. Where's that cash going to come from to make it shrink? Who's going to find that 90 days of new cash?
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, I think it extends. I think the need for liquidity continues to extend. I don't think it diminishes because that's new cash and it's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you can leverage that, right? But it's expensive to do that. So,
yeah, but I think, again, we've got too used to free money, cheap money, like 0.25% interest rate, right? So, like, the opportunity cost of capital, the ROI on capital, like, you can get cash deposit rates today over 4.5%, right? You can get that right now. You can go online and go put your money in there. Mm-hmm. So if you're funding, you know, for 90 days, you just lost 1%. And if you're a 10% EBITDA company, you just gave up 10% of your profit.
Yeah.
That's a lot, right? So, I think, like all things, there's a value of that time and cash. And depending on where you are in the supply chain and depending on your own business cycle, you're going to value it differently. If you're growing fast and investing, cash is worth much more to you than a more steady company that's not investing, right? You're in your cash cycle, you're used to it's going through. But if you're a fast-growing company, you want to build a new location, you want to invest in new machinery, having that cash coming back to you quickly is more important. So again, different people will have different needs. But yeah, I don't see it getting shorter.
Okay. Good, man. Well, that's awesome. That's not the response I expected, and that's perfect. That's exactly what I want.
Oh, hey, by the way, and what do I know, right? I could be completely wrong about that, right? I could be completely wrong about that, but that's what I think. I don't see it getting shorter anytime soon.
Okay, good. Good to know. So what's your biggest challenge in business today, sir?
Oh, it's always people, right? It's always people. It's, at Rebus, We try to run our business through culture. We try to run our business, and for us, culture is behavior.
Right.
It's not some esoteric mindset. It's are we behaving? And if you actually look at the definition of cultures, you know, this country has this culture. Well, yeah, because it's done it for 200 years, right? So the long-term practice behaviors, that's what actually ingrains the culture. Everything else is market and fluff and all of that stuff. So, but doing that's hard. Like, you know, we've let people go for missed culture fit. Mm. Even some of our top performers are generating great revenue, generating great profits, maybe a sales contributor, but they can't be a good teammate or they're way too selfish or, they'll be dishonest with themselves and the company. Can't keep that person because it would break their values. So managing that, we talk about having the courage to fail. That's a real challenge, right?
Absolutely.
The easiest thing, the easiest way to avoid failure is to do nothing.
Yep.
Which is not great for a innovative, fast-growing organization, right? We want people to fail all the time but fail in the best way you possibly can and learn and move forward. And
that's right.
You know, we inherit people from, you know, other organizations or people that are 20 years in the career where they've been taught avoid failure at all costs. And I'm this crazy Scottish guy saying, go fail. Like, just like with our customers' hearts and minds, they're like, yeah, sure, big guy. I'm not doing that. Like, if I do nothing, I don't fail, right?
Well, that's so, it, man.
Yeah, it's that. That's the hardest thing. But we work really hard at it. I don't profess to got it right or get it right every time, but we're trying, man. We're really trying to get it right.
Oh, I know you are. There's definitely, you know, there's a lot more to learn in mistakes. Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer in that. And speaking of culture, that was kind of brought into a culture of my parents and older, where you don't make mistakes, you don't show them. And they taught us that. And I hope we can get away from that. Certainly, we talk about it on this show a lot. And I'm glad to hear that you're doing it too. That's cool. Mistakes.
Yeah, I make lots.
Tons. And admitting it and being okay with it and being a leader to show people that it's okay to say that, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, but again, you're not changing. You're not changing a 1 month opinion. You're changing. You're dead right. Like, you know, many of our parents trained us to avoid failure.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So you got it at home. You got it at school. You got it at your first job. You got it at your second job. You got it at your third job. Yeah. Forget all of that.
Exactly.
Do it this way.
Yeah.
Of course they're not going to go.
It's going to be hard.
Yeah. It's going to be hard. And again, the persistence comes up in there, and positive reinforcement of failure, which sounds a really, it's an oxymoron almost.
Yeah.
But we try and do that. And if we're going to try and change something, we're going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
So get over yourself, right? Like, how on earth can you possibly think you've got all the answers for something? There's no manual, there's no book, right? We're trying to do things that has never been done before. Logically, we will fail a lot. So accept that, make as few as you can, pivot and adjust, accept your failures as quick as you can, and go try something else and keep going. But it's easy for me to say that. It's hard to get a whole organization to embrace it. So there's the type of challenges we have in our business, but we'll keep at it, right? We'll just keep going.
Yeah, cool. All right, man. Well, look, it's been an honor. I there's so much to learn from you. I could talk to you for hours and ask you questions, but I know you're busy. So
yeah, I gotta go.
I'll let you go. Any parting words for the audience?
No, look, I just all of us, right? All of us in the industry have got an opportunity to get better, right? If you take an objective look at how we run our businesses, and mine included, we definitely can get better. And I just, you know, things that kill industries and businesses are statements like, we've always done it that way, right? Right? So I encourage you just to embrace the fact that you can probably get better in some way, right? Like, I'm sure we're all good at certain things, but we can all get better in some way. And, you know, Rebus is just trying to do that. We're just trying to help the industry get a little bit better. And I would encourage everybody to open their minds that, and again, whether you're working with Rebus or not, just try and get better and accept there's opportunity, right? There's opportunity to get better. And if we can embrace that, maybe we're talking 10 years from now and, you know, I'm wrong about the cash thing and it's got better.
Or
whatever, right? Maybe. Yeah. So I think if we all try and get better and accept that it's impossible to assume that we've got everything right, we'll move forward together quicker, right? And I would love that to happen.
Beautiful advice, man. All right, John, thank you very much.
No worries. It's
been an honor. And talk to you again.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks, Greg. I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Greg Sheldon here, your host of Metal, Steel, Manufacturing, and Business Pro Podcast, where you learn everything about the metals and manufacturing industry that make your modern day life possible.